You're listening to The Review, first broadcast on the 31st of August 2013 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to The Review, your weekly preview and review of the arts here on Monocle 24, coming to you from Studio One at Midori House with me, Robert Bounds, and Gillian DeBias.
Coming up on today's programme, it's been one of the most hyped TV series this summer, but is the fifth series of Breaking Bad worth the wait?
I can't go to the police. I can't stop laundering your money. I can't keep you out of this house. I can't even keep you out of my bed.
We'll also be hearing what's on musician Beatty Wolf's playlist and discussing who's pushing the boundaries of film and theatre with some of the team behind the Nomad Cinema.
Plus, we head to the Middle East for some cultural tips from Beirut and a review of Tel Aviv's latest exhibition openings.
Even though definitely things have changed and there's internet and there's big communication, there's still a very slow diffusion of art arriving here.
There is literally a ton of stuff to look forward to on this edition of The Review, coming to you live on Monocle 24. And aren't we bright and fresh and early, Gillian DeBias?
We are, Robert Bound, with a husky voice.
I've got a bit of a husky voice. I know that you were in last night doing a bit of revision, watching Breaking Bad. You were testing out the DVD player. I was out and about.
I don't think I should have put a jumper on or a scarf. I thought this was the week it was all work and no play this week.
Oh, yeah, well, I've ticked all that off, you see. You know, so I allowed myself a little bit of rock and roll. I managed to swap clothes with someone. I woke up this morning and found them on my bedroom floor.
I don't want to
delve into this further. Isn't that a bizarre thing to find on a Saturday morning when you're rushing around and wondering if the tube's going to work and if you're going to be able to get and do a live radio show on time?
So, in fact, quite a miracle that you're sitting, coming to you live, I promise you, listeners, we are coming.
A miracle. You cited there in your introduction that this was the work and no play.
I know.
Week.
Well, you were putting the issue to bed.
We've put
you?
The October issue to bed.
Oh, what can we expect in your culture
it's,
pages?
It's a kind of busy section. We've gone to Jaffa, on the sort of outskirts of Tel Aviv, on the with the port of Jaffa, and it's a really it's kind of a cool place. I-24 is a new news channel. It's not Israeli, but it is run by Israelis. That's kind of the I stands for international. Apparently. And it's kind of possibly Israel's answer to Al Jazeera. So that's a cool thing. We went and
Amazing.
Met the sort of the producers, the anchors, the makeup girls. You know how we like those pictures in Monocle of a news anchor being buffed up by a makeup girl.
And does it look?
I mean,
do the pictures look? Do the pictures look really different? Because we, you know, you travel the world and you do different news networks. Does this look like? You know, how have they branded themselves?
It kind of looks quite straight. Actually, it looks quite. It doesn't. It's not a kind of a visual kind of onslaught. I mean, it's pretty traditional. It's not a mega big budget thing. It's not like Al Jazeera. It doesn't have Qatar's sort of mega bucks behind it. It's a little bit more homespun.
And it's quite soft opening, isn't it? You can just see it now online.
Yeah,
it?
I guess you can watch it. There's that thing that which I'll have
called
to Google
internet.
Later. I'll just Google the internet and find out where it is. There's that great website where you can watch all the kind of rolling news channels if you're of that kind of particular bent, if you'd want to do that. Sod it. We've got Breaking Bad to discuss, haven't we? Who wants to look at the news?
And it is safe to say that television drama has been having a bit of a renaissance around the world, from the crime noir of The Killing and Borgen to the family-friendly period drama Downton Abbey and the incredible Netflix reinterpretation of House of Cards. And one production which is on every TV critic's lips right now is Breaking Bad.
Season 5 is gearing up to its big finale. 11 out of 16 episodes have aired on AMC in the US and are available on Netflix, and 12th goes out this weekend. So we're just hours away from finding out the ultimate fate of chemistry teacher turned criminal mastermind Walter White.
Well, I'm delighted to welcome Alice Vincent, entertainment writer for the Daily Telegraph and self-confessed Breaking Bad obsessive, to the studio today to give us her take on the final series so far. Welcome, Alice.
Thank you. Hi.
Well, I have to say, I mean, literally, although I've been hearing everyone talk about it, I just had never got round to seeing Breaking Bad. So last night when I knew it was on the show, I thought, uh-oh. And Rob's right. You know, I watched episode and episode back to back as my homework. And God, what a treat. But for those out there who are like me, who haven't watched it, just try and set it up and why it's been so compulsive.
Yeah, well, the thing about it is it's a very dark comedy, very dark indeed. But it's also very compulsive. I mean, I think it's sort of coincidental that it's about a very addictive drug, because the TV is like a kind of crack. I think if you get past the first very gritty episodes, you're into it. And the real hook is that you've got this very suburban idyll in a very sleepy part of Albuquerque in New Mexico. But there's a twist in that this chemistry teacher decides to break bad and builds this meth empire and builds this meth empire on a very pure form of the drug. And he gets completely mad over it and turns into a very evil villain.
So is he kind of into the drug himself? His former friends, his ex-wife and all the rest of it sort of make it big and he kind of makes it bad, right? That's kind of one of the ideas behind it. Does he get into the drug or does he just kind of profit from it?
He never takes it. In fact, his partner is a sort of on and off junkie and he's very condemning of that, which is ironic.
They're always the worst ones, aren't they? Yeah, come on. I think I'm kind of almost auditioning for a role in it with my voice today. I kind of feel like
you could definitely have a dark character in there.
Yeah, exactly. And it's stylistically, it's kind of famed and kind of lauded for its kind of stylistic stuff. There's lots of, we were looking in the office yesterday, a whole montage of POV shots of, you know, cameras in a washing machine, this here, there, everywhere. So there's a kind of very neat kind of look to it as well.
It's so cleverly done. Part of the reason why fans get so obsessive about it is because the colours in it, the costumes in it, the shots in it are so well thought out. Colour is a huge part of the show, and many of the characters' sort of arcs are shown through their outfits, and things like the colours of the big desert skies in Albuquerque are the same colours of this meth, this blue meth that he creates.
I was reading, I haven't seen, as I say, I've only done four episodes, but, you know, in season two, apparently, there's this pink teddy bear with one eye, and there's apparently this great play on the colour pink and the teddy bear appearing in different parts of the series. Incredible attention to detail, and then meaning, so everyone can have fun sort of interpreting and searching for those symbols.
Yeah, very much. The pink teddy bear, it's this sort of harbinger of doom. You see it flash through the series, and then eventually, I'm not going to spoiler it for listeners, but eventually you see what happens as a result of it. But pink is also a colour that is, from them, sort of seen as a colour of doom, and yet their infant baby, Walter White's infant baby, is always dressed in pink. So for five series, we've watched
her. You're wondering what the hell's going to happen.
And it's that uncomftable
feeling.
It's very uncomfortable,
We've got a little clip, haven't we? Should we play a little bit of this and then we can discuss it at length? I'm not entirely sure where this clip's going to take us. We'll see where we come out at the end.
There's no denying the popularity of our product. There's a market to be filled. Currently, no one to fill it.
A lot of money to be made.
Obviously, Jesse and I have manufacturer covered. But there's still distribution. You want to take me on? You want to take away my children? What's the plan?
I don't know! I will count every minute that the kids are away from here, away from you, as a victory. I can't go to the police. I can't stop laundering your money. I can't keep you out of this house. I can't even keep you out of my bed.
Wow. I had the hairs, right? The hairs are sort of raised on the back of my neck. So that's from season five, which is just, this is the season that's on right now.
Well, season five's a bit complicated because last summer, the first half of season five ended on a massive cliffhanger. And so they've just picked up the rest of season five now. So we are technically in it, but the second half of it.
Okay.
And season five is meant to be the last in the series.
It is, yes. It's interesting. The show is actually, many have compared it to Shakespearean play, the structure. And at the moment, a Shakespearean tragedy, very much the final act, fifth act, is where it all goes down. But that was an interesting clip because it sort of perfectly encapsulated the two aspects of Walter White's life. So he's got his family and he's got his drug empire, and they're always at odds with each other.
And I wanted to ask you about the consensus among TV critics, because it's obviously nice. It's always nice to be someone singing from the same hymn sheet and everyone sort of saying this is a masterpiece, this is a wonderful thing. But who are the first people to pick it up? Because on TV in the UK, for example, it's sort of hidden away. What channel is it on here?
Well, that's the thing. It's been a real sleeper hit.
Yeah.
Totally.
People have only really been out. I don't think it's ever been on a UK channel here. So people have been really into it through DVDs.
Right.
And then Netflix began screening it. And a lot of people admit signing up to Netflix purely to get Breaking Bad. So it's been one of those things that the first people who picked it up sort of are people who are probably into American TV anyway and then got the DVDs.
Again, a bit like a drug. You have to have your dealer who's going to give you the copies and the episodes.
Do you know, I don't know what you mean.
Of Breaking Bad.
And it's produced by AMC. These are the guys that do Mad Men as well. Am I right? Mm-hmm. And maybe it's Showtime or Californication. I can't even remember. But these are kind of these production companies that I'm not sure they sort of seem to have come from nowhere. I mean, HBO is obviously the big name in kind of cable TV and sort of subscription TV, I guess, in the US. But there seem to be a lot of these production companies that are sort of snapping at the heels of HBO, and I suppose it all comes from the streaming culture rather than actually being on a network, right?
It's really interesting you say that, actually. Yeah, because Netflix have made no bones about how they really want to be the next HBO, and they're doing that by creating this very binge friendly TV. and there are other channels doing it as well. But with AMC, Breaking Bad has been a real success story. Like 5.9 million people in America tuned into the returning episode of season 5, which is four times the amount who originally watched the first episode, the pilot. So it's been a huge
growth. But it's interesting. I think it also reflects the fact that a lot of the people financing film at the moment are not as brave. And, you know, they probably, like with Behind the Candelabra, they're not taking up some of the riskier projects. So cinema viewing can be a little disappointing because it's so safe. So some of the most interesting things are being made episodically in television.
Mm. I think it's also the way that you can watch it. Obviously, a film, you have to invest so much time and money. But Breaking Bad, originally, I think they wanted to kill off the main protagonists after the first series. And obviously, they could have done that and called it quits and left. But all of the series that Netflix has commissioned as originals, they've recommissioned for a second series, which shows that they're sort of playing suck it and see. And I think a lot of these smaller channels are doing the same thing.
I want to ask you about your job as a TV critic. It's something that I think we all would love to do. It's a great thing. It's clearly not just sitting on the sofa with a humongous bag of popcorn. Or maybe it's about box of Walker Sensations and some hummus, Gillian. I'm a broad church. But how does it work? I mean, how far in advance do you kind of watch everything? Because it's previewing and reviewing. I mean, it's kind of a lot out there to sort of digest, right?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not purely a critic, a sort of entertainment writer in general. So when I'm lucky, it's all right. I just don't want to be giving any false impressions. But we are able to watch previews of things.
Yeah.
But I think a big part of the job is really sort of being very much into the programme. That's when it's fun to write about as well.
And is reviewing a TV series a bit like films these days, where you have to sign off that you're not going to talk about it before it gets released, and you have to do all sorts of contracts almost before you get access?
There's
to
a lot of embargoed things, yeah. It means that, especially with things like Twitter as well, you've got to be quite tight-lipped about things. And it's quite interesting at the moment with Breaking Bad in particular, because the only way we can access it is by watching it on Netflix like everybody else. So you've kind of got to do a rush job on it to
judge it before somebody else. And just finally, what do you think of this series? Is it up there with the rest of them?
Well, it's interesting because it started quite slowly and sort of brought people back. And it was very much one for the fans in the first two episodes. And then the episode that was aired last week, episode 11, it was back on Vince Gilligan, writer. It was
back on form.
Yeah. Each of your seats.
How many before the end?
I think there's five left. And at the end of every single episode of the series, it's like it could end then. You know, he's stringing it out for sure.
I love this now. I'm going to go and binge.
I've cancelled all my weekend plans. And I'm going to be on the sofa with my...
The sun's out, stoke up the DVD player. Alice Vincent, entertainment writer for The Telegraph. Thank you so much for coming on The Review. If you're interested in watching Breaking Bad, all the series so far are available on Netflix. You're tuned in to Monocle 24. We'll be back in a second for our weekly cultural roundup from around the world.
Each week on The Curator, one of our Monocle editors rounds up the very best of the week just gone on Monocle 24.
Well, I went to Afghanistan under the Taliban when I was 26 years old, and I sort of just saved my money and went to photograph women living under the Taliban. And now I realize, wow, that was pretty dangerous.
From hard-hitting political interviews to live music sessions, from food and film to retail and travel, we'll handpick the best of the week's shows for an hour of essential listening.
Affair at the end is on the one side a market platform, but I think especially here in Asia and in Southeast Asia, it should also be a place of an exchange, of a get-together.
That's The Curator, premiering every Saturday at 9 a.m. London time
on Monocle 24, brought to you in association with Rolex.
And you are listening to The Review here on Monocle 24 with me, Gillian Tobias, and Robert Bound. And over in our Toronto bureau, Monocle's Nelly Gotcheva has been hard at work digging out the best cultural offerings from around the world. And here she is to guide us through her weekend picks.
This weekend, head to the Architecture and Design Museum in LA for the Never Built Los Angeles exhibition. It takes a special look at the dreams of architects and designers who envisioned a different kind of urban plan for the city. Imagine endless green spaces and parks, plus a very different LAX airport. Never Built Los Angeles is on until the 13th of October. If in France, head to the small town of Perpignan for the opening of Visa for l'Image, the world's largest international photojournalism festival, which is now celebrating its 25th anniversary. This year's edition also features a large retrospective of British war photojournalist Don McCullen. The festival is on until the 7th of September. Opening this Saturday in Melbourne is David Mach's latest exhibition, From Nowhere to Nowhere, at Beam Contemporary Art Gallery. On display are the latest photos, videos and sculptures by the Australian artist. From Nowhere to Nowhere is on until the 28th of August. And if in Istanbul this weekend, check out On the Eve, the third solo exhibition by provocative Italian sculptor Francesco Albano. The challenging show is organized by Istanbul's Gallerist Art Gallery in collaboration with Mimar Sinan University. For more details, go to gallerist.com.tr. On our playlist this weekend, we have Wisconsin-born singer-songwriter Zola Jesus and her latest album, Versions. And now let's hear Fall Back. For Monocle, in Toronto, I'm Nelly Gotcheva.
And that was Fall Back by Zola Jesus. Zola Jesus? Who knows? That report there was from Nelly Gotcheva. Up next, BT Wolf. That was a nice short sting, wasn't it?
Very kind of, short
if
sting,
you,
yeah.
If we weren't such experienced broadcasters, that could have taken us by surprise.
It could have.
Luckily.
Rob.
It is time now for our weekly music review. Listeners to my weekly culture show will be no stranger to our guest today. Back in June 2012, she performed a wonderful Midori House session for us, and she's just released her new album, 8, cited as the world's first 3D interactive album release.
Well, for the one or two listeners who may have missed that show last year, we're talking about the singer-songwriter BT Wolf. And I'm delighted to say she joins us in the studio now to give us her taste, a little bit of a taste of her new album and to talk us through some of the tracks that have influenced her. Hello, welcome.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, it's so nice to have you in our studio on a Saturday in London. Are you here sort of, is this just a little bit of a kind of summer rest for you in London, or are you sort of at work?
Well, it kind of still is, because I'm here for another 10 days. Then I go off to the US for our East Coast, West Coast tour, which is going to take probably about a month. So I'm kind of gearing up for that and, you know, enjoying the last week of...
The last of the summer days,
yeah,
as well,
exactly,
here in London.
Exactly. So it's very cool to do this now.
So, yeah, you're getting on the bus.
I am getting on the bus.
That's the thing. It's the troubadour's life.
First class planes, actually, Rob, you know, all the way.
Good to hear.
I always wanted to walk onto a plane with a guitar strung over my back, like the front cover of Born in the USA.
Oh, yeah.
Or back cover of Born in the USA. Yeah, but I can't.
It
doesn't really look that good in economy.
No, I know.
Can't really do it. You know, I kind of keep on banging into
people.
I know. So I hit some poor Indian man in the face with a, you know, plectrums falling out all over the place.
Yeah,
that's the problem. We're going to talk. You've chosen some tracks for us to sort of lead us through some of your creative process.
Yes, absolutely.
And we're going to play a track first from the new record from 8, and this is called Danger Blue. Maybe you can tell us a little bit about it, and then we're going to hit play.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I actually, it's funny because I wrote it in Colorado, which is somewhere I won't be going this time. But
I thought you were going to say, I won't be going back there in a hurry. You get thrown out of the state. What happened?
No, nothing. It was a very pleasant experience, but it really came from nowhere, up in the mountains, you know, in the snow. And I heard this melody and kind of put it to paper. So, you know, that's the essence of it.
Breathe in and smell the Colorado in this track. This is Danger Blue, Beatty Wolf. It's beautiful stuff. Danger Blue from Beatty Wolf, who's our musical
Amazing.
Guest on the review this Saturday morning, Gillian. That's pretty good. We're swaying in the studio.
Oh, that's amazing. I have, it's almost a very embarrassing, naive question, but I've never played a musical instrument. I could not create a song if my life depended on it. And I've always wanted to ask, but almost be too embarrassed to ask. So what comes first? Do the lyrics come first? Do the songs come first? I mean, there are only so many notes. I just don't know how.
It's not a silly question at all. It's actually one I think a lot of people are curious about. And my answer is kind of, there isn't really an answer. Sometimes, you know, there'll be a melody. Other times I'll have a poem that I'll want to put to, you know, put to music. But weirdly, a lot of them come together. So it's almost like there's something pregnant in the air and I'm like, okay, I gotta capture this, and I'll pick up the guitar and it will just happen in a very sort of fluid process, which is amazing. You know, that's when you feel like it's really coming through you.
Plucking these things out of the ether.
It's how Rob writes.
Oh dear. Yeah, well, you know, that's the thing. There's obviously something out there. That foul stench in the air. I'll have a bit of that. I'll put it on paper. you've also chosen some tracks that sort of tell us about how you write and why you write and some of the things you dig, some of the things that maybe influence the way you do business. When I say do business, I mean writing songs.
The business of music.
So tell us about the next track. This is a Chili Peppers track, right?
It is a Chili Peppers track. And if there is one album that sort of opened the musical door for me, it was the album Blood Sugar Sex Magik that was produced by Rick Rubin, who I have the utmost respect for as a producer. I heard it when I was 8 and I was blown away. And it's a song called Breaking the Girl. And if you hear like just something of how he, you know, records and produces, he's so interested in like the silence and the space between instrumentation. And he makes the musicians get into that really pure creative state where it is just about getting that perfect take. And I think this song is magic.
Still
Breaking the Girl. I thought I'd just be on the wrong page. I forgot the name of that song. Red Hot Chili Peppers from Blood Sugar Sex Magic. That is pretty good. I wonder, that's a kind of, it's an unusual thing, that drum, the sort of drums are kind of strange.
The drums are so cool.
Yeah.
And it just, this isn't a, you know, not punning on it, but it really gives me chills when I listen to that. Yeah. And when you watch the documentary, I think it's Funky Monks, and you're seeing how they recorded that, like the drums particularly, they are just bashing, like, you know, massive steel pots with sticks, and it's just so raw and kind of primal.
It is. It's got a really, it's got a kind of jungle rhythm to it. It's a lovely thing, that, isn't it?
And your performance is like the whole physicality of important. I mean, you're slightly different, though, but in terms of the stage and the physicality.
Yeah, I mean, I play with wonderful musicians, Adam Hayes on drums and Yaron Stavi on double bass, and that, you know, it is still very raw. It's just the three of us. It's bass, drums, guitar. And I can't play without moving. So I'm sort of, you know, jiving all over the place. Sometimes my microphone's, you know, not really moving with me, which can be problematic.
And what did you say? Oh, okay, she's back.
Yeah. but it does make me kind of want to do a few tracks where I'm not playing guitar and I'm just singing. Mm. And I can move like James Brown. That would be, you know, ideal.
That is the one. That is the thing.
Yeah.
Before we kiss goodbye to the Red Hot Chili Peppers, obviously there is a famous debate. I'm on one side of it. I feel you might be on the other side of it. Mm. Under the Bridge, I think the All Saints version is the best. True. It's a true fact. Anyway, don't frown at me, BT.
No,
it's
fine.
I think
Never Ever, though. I beat their Never Ever, definitely.
Yeah, okay. Let's have that. Exactly. We better cue up our next track, bit of Bowie.
Never goes amiss. And I think this is, you know, Bowie's production is kind of, you know, pretty damn spot on. And it's that perfect balance of feel good without being cheesy. This is tonight, him singing with Tina Turner.
Well, we left the sunshine outside to come into the studio, but luckily we brought a little bit in the form of some calypso there.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's great. That's great, isn't it? Mm. What record is that from? I'm kind of...
You know what? I knew you were going to ask me that, and I was thinking...
I just had a surreptitious look on my iTunes, and
and that's why it's sort of quite an unknown one. But I think it's, you know...
Great song.
Yeah, and also just that balance of, like, male and female vocals. Yeah. You know, they're really sort of strengthening one another.
This is such a treat, getting your, like, your Desert Island disc. I love this.
It's good, isn't it?
It's really good.
I want to be invited onto this show. I'm going to interview myself. Another raging debate is this song, Tonight with Tina Turner, David Bowie. Better or worse than... Look at my screen. Look, it's Mick and David Bowie dancing in the street. Quite possibly the worst music video of all time, and one of the strangest combinations for a song, right?
Which countries are they? Do they list?
I think they kind of give up. They kind of go Spain, Portugal, South America. They can't think of a specific country. It's like the country of Africa. They obviously need to be sat down and given at least a half hour primer in basic geography.
Yeah, your job.
Exactly. I'm going to be there with a chalkboard and a stick. Come on, Mick, face the front. That's put me in a good mood, the Bowie. And we've got one last one. Tell us about this.
This sounds great.
So this is a new track that I'm really loving at the moment. And it comes from a brand new male and female duo called B&B. This is kind of moving on from David Bowie and Tina Turner. These guys could be next. It's currently unreleased, but you can hear it posted on a number of blogs. And it's been described by one, Hilly Dilly, as music so good and well-intentioned that if there were any music that could provide mental shelter, it would be that of B&B. And I completely agree with that statement. This is God Knows. Honey, 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 honey.
B&B, God knows.
Yes.
I love the sound of that.
Yeah.
It's got a kind of, again, it's got a bit of a calypso vibe to it.
It does. It really does.
I can
does.
Almost taste the rum there somehow.
I think it's just a running
theme
just
last
with
night.
You.
yeah, that is a lovely thing. It's, I love those sort of, there's a kind of naivety to those synths. It's a kind of, it's not a kind of snap synth. It's kind of a mellifluous.
Absolutely.
I really like that. Let's get that on the playlist. They're nodding behind the glass.
Yeah.
Yeah, that sounds really good. And you've got to, we've got to kind of wrap it up there, BTB.
Sure.
You've got to tell us about your tour. Where are you going from and to in your van?
I'm starting in San Francisco, then San Diego, Texas, Boston, New York, and with one stop off in LA.
Nice.
For a little meeting.
And your meeting?
I'm meeting Leonard Cohen's manager in LA for the first time since we started chatting about 4 years ago. So
possible collaboration?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, there's already been one on Thousand Kisses Deep. Mm. But yeah, it would be really good to meet in flesh.
Amazing.
What a man. Laughing Len.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Thank you very much, BT Wolf, for coming in. The record 8 is out now.
It is out.
Got a very handsome vinyl of it upstairs.
Yeah.
Looks good. Sounds good. Thank you so much. What are we doing next? We've got Thomas's look ahead. Right?
We are. We're going to cross to the Middle East now for today's City Look Ahead. Monocle's Tom Lewis has been in Beirut and has sent us this report on what's coming up over there in the coming days.
Beirut might be a city not quite at ease with itself at the moment, but it is a city that is used to keeping the show on the road as the clouds darken around it. Go to any of Beirut's rooftop bars and you'll see a pretty healthy turnout of mostly young Lebanese raising a glass to the summer. Iris, next to the Al-Nahar building, which houses one of the Middle East's most prominent newspapers, is a good place to start for your tour of Beirut from above. Down below, Beirut's drinking and eating scenes are ever-shifting entities. The once bustling Jemaisi area is slowly giving way to Mar Mechaya, a stone's throw north near the Matrix-like National Electricity Building. Art lovers should get their fix here too. Head to Plan B, an artist collective that's currently showing reworked posters from some of Lebanon's most famous music festivals. Ella Fitzgerald and Lebanon's most celebrated daughter, Feyrouz, are some of the faces peering out of the gallery walls. Why not keep a lookout for a live graffiti performance too, which are springing up increasingly around the city's art hubs. Music lovers should keep an eye out for Beirut's Symphony Orchestra, which performs across the city throughout August. But for something a little more eclectic, head to the Biel Industrial Neighbourhood and the Music Hall, an open-air corrugated iron venue which has a veritable conveyor belt of artists, from Italian opera stars to Dominican rappers to the Shehadeh brothers, two of Lebanon's most famous singers. Night owls will also be glad to hear that things don't really get started here until around midnight. As the mood in Beirut shifts with the events that are seeping ever further into it, the bars, it seems, will continue to top up your glass. The beaches will still bring you clean towels, and the restaurants will still bring the dessert menu, even if you're the only one there to take them up on the offer. For Monocle, in Beirut, I'm Tom Lewis.
Cheers, Thomas. You're tuned in to The Review on Monocle 24. We'll be back to explore what happens when you take film out of the cinema in a sec.
You've read the magazine, you've listened to the radio, and you've even made it to our new cafe. But now there's more, a lot more. Hitting bookshelves this September is Monocle's first book, The Monocle Guide to Better Living. It's a quiet manifesto for doing things well that runs from the macro to the micro. Over 400 pages of fresh editorial, great illustrations and stunning photography, we look at what makes a great city, how to build a home you'll always love, why it's good to have a Shibiken dog by your side and a cocktail from the Dragonfly Bar in your hand. The Monocle Guide to Better Living will be available in all good bookshops around the world, and you can also order it at monocle.com. Happy reading!
And welcome back to the studio. It's Saturday and you're listening to The Review with me, Jillian Tobias and Robert Bound.
And a few weeks ago here on the show, we ran through some of our favourite outdoor cinemas around the world. But in some cities, cinephiles have been taking things further than just watching a film in the open air. From staging pop-up screenings in creative locations to commissioning live soundtrack performances, the world of film viewings is becoming increasingly imaginative. And it's a trend that's popping up in theatre too.
Well, one organisation who's been experimenting here in London with the notion of where and how you screen a film is Nomad Cinema. And here to tell us more about what they do and to talk about fellow innovators in the world of pop-up productions, we're joined in studio by Juliet McCrimmon, event producer for Nomad Cinema and cinephile and creative Clive Perrott. Welcome to The Review.
Hello.
It's nice to meet you in person. You don't look at all like your photographs on your website, which I have to say to listeners, they're photographs of these two when they're about 4 or 6 years old.
I don't think they've changed that much.
So what first made you think of the idea of Nomad Cinema?
Well, the Nomad was formed about 3 years ago. It's a sister company of a independent cinema in Kensal Rise called the Lexi Cinema. Mm. And both organisations are run by Sally Walton, who's the founder and dreamer of the two companies. And her passion is to raise money for a charity in South Africa called the Sustainability Institute. And what that does is we raise money for children who otherwise wouldn't have such a great start in life. And we're donating money over there to create schools and creches and workshops. And our great success story at the moment is one of the boys who's been through this program has now just been accepted into a film school in Cape Town, which
that's
is
amazing.
I know, really,
that's
really
full
amazing.
Circle, isn't it?
That's amazing.
Absolutely.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And I like the branding of the Nomad Cinema. It's nice. Your camel.
Yes.
Wandering around through
roaming.
The city of London, roaming.
Yes.
Is that wandering? Yeah, not wandering, roaming, right? Yeah,
kind of
right.
We sleep in a yurt at night.
I know you do. I love it. I love it. Close the tent flap. It's a bit windy.
For sure. That's where we do all our Facebooking and we post our pictures from our yurt and then rock up in my camper van.
Absolutely. And it's that happy coincidence of great locations as well as the films. I guess, obviously, you try to match up the films with the locations as much as possible. But some of them are really kind of underused locations. I think you were showing Annie Hall, I've probably got, or maybe Where the Wild Things Are, in Coram Inn Fields.
Yes.
Sort of that big, lovely, slightly forgotten green space in Bloomsbury.
It is. It's right next to Coram Fields. It's actually Coram's Secret Garden
that we've gone into.
And it's this amazing, like you say, very quietly, nobody's to know. It's a little undiscovered gem right next to Coram Fields. And honestly, you walk in this rather urban-looking pathway, and then you turn the corner, and that is a massive part of our season, actually, seeing the joy on people's faces as they walk into these undiscovered gems. There's Coram Secret Films, Coram Secret Gardens, where we have two more films showing, The Lost Boys. And then we also, another venue we use is Hyde Park Lido, which is a bit like that as well.
Yeah.
Nobody knows about Hyde Park Lido. Everybody knows about the Serpentine Lido, but there's this little garden up above that nobody knows about. And just seeing people's faces as they walk in, about to watch a really great film in this really amazing undiscovered gem is really, really lovely.
Well, you mentioned the word joy, and Clive, I was wondering, I mean, with all the multiplexes, sometimes the joy of watching movies disappears.
I think so. I was thinking about this. I'm sort of on the edge of Nomad. I'm not actually part of it. I'm a sort of advisor, because I'm a boring film buff. I love movies. But I think you're absolutely right, and I saw Where the Wild Things Are. And I thought, okay, the location is wonderful. The film is good. It's a good film. The dressing, the set dressing, all the staff, the wonderful people from Nomad. But it's the audience. Mm. You gather a whole bunch of people that really want to share an experience, and they create the work for you. It was such a happy environment. My kids loved it. They were made such a fuss of. But I think that is it. You show the right film. For example, I think I'm right in saying that Nomad are going to do work, collaborate with the BFI on a Hitchcock season. I'm there.
Yeah.
I'm so excited about it.
I want to know where the locations are.
Well, I'll tell you where. It's in Leytonstone. They're going back to where he was born and brought up. I mean, it's an obvious idea that I don't think anybody's ever done before. But the Nomad and BFI, and who else is it?
Create London
have decided that let's go to the source. Let's look specifically at the architecture that Hitchcock sort of lived and breathed, and then let's show his films. And I think that's such a wonderful take on rediscovery, because I don't know if you're film buffs as well. I watch a film over and over and over again until I take all the fun out of it.
And so, but you don't quote it back at the person. You're not trying, because it's that thing when you put a DVD on and you're trying to convert someone.
Yeah,
you know,
you'll like this bit. This is a good bit.
Just going to pause it and tell you why this is funny.
I hope you don't do that in the screenings.
I'm so tempted to. I'm so they gag me before.
But I like that idea that if you're saying that the audience kind of make it, because that is kind of the vibe of Nomad, and it's almost more of a theatrical experience rather than a cinematic experience. Where there is more onus on the audience to kind of give something back.
Isn't that
despite the fact it's still just a screen?
About cinema and theatre merging together and those edges and parameters disappearing now. Look in the West End, where the theatre is so influenced by cinema. We've got The Bodyguard, we've got Shrek, we've got Charlie and the Chocolate Factory. So those differences disappear now. Yes, I love theatre and cinema coming together. Punch Drunk.
Yeah.
Love Punch Drunk. They're doing a play at the National called, what is it?
The Drowning Man.
The Drowning Man, which was all about Hollywood on the cusp in the 60s as it's decomposing and corrupting. Yeah. And I'm there. I want to go and see that at the National.
And tell us about Punch Drunk. You've got to fill our listeners in. This is sort of interactive theatre company. They do things a very different way. Mm. Were these the first guys to be doing that sort of thing?
They started, I don't know, some years back, not that long ago. Their path to success has been very rapid, I think. They did a production of Faust, which I didn't see, but it had amazing reviews. And they came from sort of nowhere. The next thing they did was they took over the Battersea Arts Centre and they did a tribute to Edgar Allan Poe. As the artistic director of the Edgar Allan Poe Society, I was thrilled that they did that. And it was wonderful. It was totally immersive, as you say. You went there, they gave you a mask, so they took away your identity, and you didn't passively sit and watch a play. You walked around the BAC, which is this vast edifice, and just experienced different aspects of Poe's storytelling. And I think that's the same thing they're going to do with The Drowned Man. Yes, it's wonderful. You've been to see...
And they're absolutely amazing. And I wanted to ask you about finding the locations. We're sort of constantly told that, you know, famous old, you know, defunct power stations and bits and bobs, everything is kind of going to be turned into executive housing. I love that. It's executive housing. I can only make a decision if I live in this house. But it's, lots of things seem to be kind of had to be forced to turn into retail spaces. I mean, there's that huge debate that's going on at the South Bank at the moment where you need to have 62 cafes for every theatre, you know, kind of thing, which is kind of nuts. Mm. But do you feel that it's getting tougher to find venues, interesting venues to put stuff on?
I think it is tough, but I think there's enough out there, particularly if you slightly spill out of London. Obviously, we've got this amazing, we're thrilled to be back with the Royal Parks, I think, for the third year running now, and we go to Brompton Cemetery. Have you ever been
there? Yeah, which I love. Yeah, which is amazing.
It's extraordinary. Yeah. And to have to be able to put a screen up at the end of that amazing pathway and show a slightly spooky film.
What are you showing there?
This year we're showing Donnie Darko.
That really freaked me out watching that, isn't there?
I really
watched it. Some huge rabbits creeping around behind you.
Yeah. Scary rabbits in the archways. Exactly. And also Edward Scissorhands.
And it is about the experience, though. It's not just the lights go down and everyone watches me. It's like the before that's very much part of the
Absolutely.
Experience.
We try and create a kind of film festival ethos about us. It's the attention to detail. It's the decoration that's slightly in theme with the film. With Brompton Cemetery, we'll bring in infrastructure just to make it absolutely magical for the audience. So it's not just putting a screen up and showing a great film, which is wonderful, but we just try and bring an extra element in as well, so it is quite immersive without obviously going over to the secret theme. Cinema because they're brilliant at that, but we just try and bring the audience in and make them feel part of it, and very important, everybody's a special guest at one of our screenings.
I think it's funny, isn't it, that sometimes the film itself becomes almost incidental to all the things that are happening around the edges.
It's kind of like the music at a party, isn't it? You know, you love it, but yes, you're kind of doing something kind of else in your head, aren't you?
Very much so. Yes, I think that's absolutely right. I do a little film company called The Flicker Club. It's a much smaller affair than Wonderful Nomad. But what we do is we screen films adapted from short stories or novels. That's our take on it. We're very interested in adaptation. And then we get a surprise guest. You never know who you're going to get to read from the source materials. We've had Joan Collins and Bill Nye and Mark Rylands reading from things like Soylent Green or Night of the Hunter. Mark Rylands did Night of the Hunter and got up and did a sort of revivalist meeting. It was extraordinary, to about 60 people. It was it was hysterical.
That's a hot ticket. That's really good. He's going to pull out. And that's the thing. And going back to the audience, do you have a typical audience member? Are you kind of surprised at the people sometimes that come through the gates to the Nomad?
I'm not particularly. I'm surprised by how much they get into it. We were in Queen's Park last weekend when it was the absolute biblical storms. It was extraordinary. And we were just standing in the park. We really don't want to screen a film, but we've got to. But then the audience came up and they had inflatable boats and dinghies and they just, everybody came up with such a great British spirit. We are going to enjoy the rain. And we just had such, it ended up being one of my favourite events of the season.
What film was that? Because you kind of switched it at the last minute to, you know, I don't know what. I wonder, what's that film with
Deep
the...
Calm.
Deep Calm. Well, Singing in the Rain, just go old school.
Yeah, exactly.
But it's interesting. It's kind of like the swing of the pendulum because we're all now so spoiled by the quality of computer screens and tablets and laptops. So it's a luxury to be able to watch feature films at home in the coziness in front of your fire. But suddenly now you crave for the experience and to go out and also being able to interact. And that's why pop-up is more than just appearing somewhere differently. It's that people and things can
oh yes, if you see a horror film, isn't it wonderful if people are scared and screaming around you? It's sort of it's even better than 3D, isn't it?
Well, the Nomad, a few weeks ago we worked on a film festival in Suffolk, which was just magical, and I've got high hopes of that growing as the years go on. But one of the screens that we set up was screening Jaws across Warbswick Bay, and everybody had headphones on, and so as the lights went down it was pitch black, you couldn't see your feet in front of you, so we set this inflatable screen up one side of the bay, or the audience were the other side with their headphones watching Jaws, and it was amazing because I didn't have headphones on, so I was just watching the audience, and it was like meerkats. Completely silent, and then every now and then it was a massive scream from everyone, but they forgot themselves because they couldn't hear each other.
It was very nerve-wracking actually, because the water actually merged into the screen, so that awful bit where the woman sort of eaten right at the beginning, you couldn't see where the water that you were sitting in front of disappeared into the screen. It was very unnerving.
I love that. We're going to need a bigger screen.
We're
going to need a drier screen. We've got to leave it there, unfortunately, but it's a beautiful day for a film tonight, isn't it? What is and where is tonight?
Well, tonight I have my first Saturday night off of the season. Okay. We don't have a screening tonight.
On a nice sunny day.
But I promise you the weather's going to be good for the rest of September, and we are back at Fulham Palace for another three films doing the evolution of the rom-com. So we've got Harry Met Sally, Four Weddings and a Funeral, with an exclusive Q&A with Richard Curtis, recorded with myself, one of the highlights of my life, and Amelie. Hyde Park Lido, we're showing, we really pride ourselves on our slightly interesting and quirky programming, so we've got Breathless and In the Mood for Love there, and really recommend that film.
Yeah,
it's really worth an experience. Brompton Cemetery, of course, very close to selling out, but grab a ticket if you can. Check our website because there's lots of lovely events coming up, and I promise the sun will shine. If it doesn't, I will ply you with champagne and chocolates.
The Nomad Camel wanders on.
It does.
Successfully. Juliette McCrimmon and Clive Perrott, thank you so much for joining us on The Review. What's up next?
To finish the show, we're going to be hopping out of the studio and back to the Middle East. As we heard earlier in our report from Tel Aviv, the crisis in Syria has been having an impact on the cultural life of many cities in the region. And as always, with periods of strife, good can grow out of bad when it comes to culture.
The Israeli art world is gearing up for a busy autumn schedule, so Monocle's Jerusalem correspondent Joseph Dana sat down with Vadit Gross, art critic for the leading Israeli daily. Oh, I've got a proper thing here. They've spelled it phonetically. I always find that even worse. Yediot Abronot, and they met at Tel Aviv's Museum of Art to discuss the health of the Israeli art world and some upcoming shows.
I think it's an exciting week in Tel Aviv because usually at the end of August, the year kind of starts and people go back from summer vacation because the Jewish holidays are happening early this year. Next Thursday is already the Rosh Hashanah, the new year. Then all the arts events start move to this week. So actually there's lots of opening happening in Tel Aviv this week. One really interesting event is happening tonight in Tel Aviv is called Culture on the Bar. And in 20 different bars in Tel Aviv, which is very known in its nightlife, different artists, writers, filmmakers are sitting on the bar, they're having a drink and they're talking with a crowd that is coming over specifically to hear about their practice, about the work, making small presentations. Some of them are doing surprising things. Chagai Lin Koenig, who's a winning award author, is actually going to sing a song that he wrote that he based his novel upon. There's an artist, Moan Shub, who's going to, for the first time, put a radio skit that she wrote that has different narrative parts that's supposed to grow into something larger. So it's kind of a peep into people's practice and a chance to talk to them about how they work.
Are a lot of the art events happening here, they're locals mostly? Because you hear about Israelis kind of going to Europe or New York or something and making it there. But you don't often hear about many international artists coming to Tel Aviv. Is that kind of the sense that you get, or am I off base there?
I think you're right. I think there aren't so many international artists coming over. It is changing. Actually, today there's an opening of Ugo Rondonina, who's a very important artist, in a gallery in Tel Aviv, Zomer Gallery, which is... Zomer and Dvir are two leading galleries in bringing over international artists. Right now at the Helena Rubinstein Pavilion, there's a show that also includes Janet Cardiff's 40 Quartet, which is a really great project, by the way, over there tonight. It's a show that has Janet Cardiff in it and two Israeli artists who are also dealing with sound and music. And in one of them, Naamat Sabah, who's an Israeli artist living in New York, kind of what you described in the other direction, have different musician artists coming to an installation and activating it. And today, Maya Dunitz is going to come over and try to play inside the installation. But altogether, it is still a bubble to some degree, I feel. There are many reasons for this. It's far away. It can be dangerous over here. There are boycott issues. But also, even though definitely things have changed and there's internet, there's big communication, there's still very slow diffusion of art arriving here. Not in the museums, I have to state this. In the big museums, you can see relevant shows in the right time, but less in the galleries.
That was Israeli critic Vardik Gross speaking to Monocle's Joseph Dana in Tel Aviv. Have you been to Tel Aviv?
I haven't been to Tel Aviv, no. Joseph Dana is a very busy boy.
He is.
Scurrying around.
Istanbul he's heading to.
Yeah, exactly. He's, as I said at the beginning of the show, he's done that I-24 thing, which is the Culture League for October, which is a great story. So yes, exactly. He's kind of, I should mention, he's a man that always has to wear sneakers just in case he has to run off somewhere else. He can't wear a proper shoe. In other sartorial news, I've done that thing. Well, I've basically come into the studio with wet hair and I've allowed the headphones to style my hair. It's pretty bad.
Good hair day.
Anyway, let's get out in the sunshine. That brings us to the end of this Saturday's edition of The Review. For now, it's goodbye from all of us here at Midori House. Our show today was produced by Katie Bilboa and Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our researcher was Marie-Sophie Schwarzer and our studio manager was Claire Urban.
We're handing back over to Jonathan Wheatley with Weekend Edition next, where you can catch our pick of the week's best Monocle 24 stories, guests and features on The Curator. And don't forget to tune into the Monocle Weekly, which will be on air Sunday at midday London time with Rob and Andrew.
You've been tuned in to The Review with me and Gillian. Have a great weekend and thanks for tuning in.
Bye-bye.